what if I fail, especially on Everest, when I had done all the other ones. That day when I didn't do well and I came back down to base camp and was just, you know, mentally had lost it. Pulling myself back together and refocusing and getting back to one foot in front of the other was so hard because I knew people were looking. I mean, I had quit my military career and I told the 3-star at the time, he asked me why. I said, I want to climb Mount Everest. And he rolled his eyes and shook his head and laughed. And I had to do it.
Welcome to The Dark Zone, an event racing podcast. This is your host, Brian Gatens. In event racing lingo, a dark zone is a time when, due to darkness or safety, teams are paused on the course before continuing with the race. During that time, stories are exchanged, friendships are kindled, spirits are restored, and teams have a chance to prepare for the next challenge. We hope that you make good use of this dark zone. We're glad that you're here. Today we are joined by Dave Ashley. To describe Dave solely as an event racer would be an incredible understatement of who he is and what he has accomplished. We get into Dave's story pretty quickly, so sit back, relax, and enjoy hearing all about Dave and his accomplishments. A quick programming note, during the episode, he lists many organizations, resources, and contact information, and I've placed all of them in the show notes. No need for you to try and remember them all. Enjoy today's episode, and thank you, Dave, for joining the Dark Zone, an adventure racing podcast. Dave Ashley is joining us today as the fastest living Oregon donor to climb the 7 summits. Dave is an adventure racer. He's a military veteran. We're recording this on Memorial Day. So thank you, Dave, for your service, but specifically for the service of your classmates from West Point 1997 who are no longer with us. We are very grateful for what they've brought to our country, and thank you for being here today. But Dave is recently back from Everest. Heck of a story, heck of a tale. Before we get into your experience as a alpinist and as a climber in the 7 summits, tell us a bit about your adventure racing background. How'd you get into the sport and what are the big races you've done?
Yeah, so moving in the military quite a bit. I moved into the DC area in the early 2000s and linked up with a group then called Northern Virginia Adventure Racing, NVAR. Led by Mike Spiller. And it was a group of getting together for training and then going to races, wearing the same jersey, kind of having that cohesive team atmosphere. And they recruited me after they saw me finish a race out here run by EX2 Adventures called Rocky Gap Adventure Race up in Maryland, where I won it as a soloist. And they recruited me back then to start adventure racing. And I was much more of a runner and mountain biker and not a paddler. So, but everybody's got to get in at some point, and joining a team is fantastic because you don't have the gear when you start, but in a team, you've got people that are willing to loan you what you need and then teach you on the race course. And so I spent the first couple of years learning from some of the people out here in the Virginia area who I think have really become a kind of legendary in the adventure racing scene in the United States over the years. But as I moved in the military around, I brought the racing team with me, recruited new racers, and so brought it to Nebraska, brought it to Los Angeles, brought it to Florida as I went, gaining more and more experience over the years.
What are your, in terms of race distances, are you a specialist at the 24-hour race? Do you go expedition level? What do you find your sweet spot to be?
Well, I have a lot of admiration for the people that do the expedition races. I've tried a couple of them, and they're really, really, really hard. So my favorite race is probably 18 hours to 36. You need a little bit of time to separate the teams and really get the navigation going, and that's where I tend to have better success. Versus just like the off-road triathlon style race. But once you start getting to a day and a half, 2 days of no sleep, the suffering really starts piling up quick. And I think the recovery and the amount of time that you have to invest getting to a race and doing it also start to become really big investments.
You're right. We have a race director coming on in the next few weeks, very successful. And he's very strong for the 6 to 8 hour adventure racing. He thinks that that's the sweet spot for the sport. You mentioned anywhere from 18 to 36 hours, but I do agree with you that there's such a spread between a shorter race of 4 hours, going up to 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, that there's a lot for people to do in adventure racing. And you're spot on when you said that there's a sweet spot for everybody. And I do agree with you that the 18 to 36 hours is just long enough where you dip into the fatigue and the exhaustion, but not so long that you just get clobbered. And the recovery, to your point, on the back end, it takes you out of commission for weeks at a time. And so you're right about that. What's interesting is that your experience, as we're having a conversation, your success in Adventure Racer, you and I first met, as a matter of fact, at US Nationals. I believe that was in 2019. You and I had a great conversation there at the post-race dinner. For most people, the accomplishments that you've checked off in the adventure racing world, the championships you've won, the races where you've succeeded, the teammates you've worked with, how you've grown the sport, would pretty much be the box to check off. But I believe in 2017, your life took a significant change when you decided to make a kidney donation to a colleague from West Point. Do I understand your story correctly?
Yeah, you've got that right. It certainly wasn't something I had planned to do in life, but I got a Facebook post in a group I'm a member of from all of my college classmates from West Point that one of us had a kidney problem and no one in the family was able to help. And they were looking for a living donor because the wait in this particular state is Massachusetts was about 7 years for a deceased organ, and living on dialysis, if you know anybody who's had to do that, is a real tough life. And there's certainly no guarantee that you're going to stay alive long enough to get that organ transplant. So I don't consider myself a super good altruistic person. I figured I'd get tested, I'd get told no, I'd go to sleep feeling like I did my part. They said, hey, let's do some more tests. I did some more tests. They said, hey, we want you to come up to the hospital. And that's about the point where I said, I better ask my wife though. What she thinks about
this. Whoa. Like I'm okay with this. I'm good checking off the box of being the good guy, but I really got to get through with this. You thought you'd get knocked out of the process. And I can relate to that experience. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So things did work out that I ended up doing the donation. But the big lagging question in my mind was, what's life going to be like after I donate from my endurance racing perspective? I like bike packing. I like, 24 to 48 hour races. I like to do ultra marathons. Can I not do that at all? Will I still be competitive or not? And I couldn't find anybody who could answer that question. And so I went into that surgery with just not knowing, crossing my fingers and hoping I'd be able to get back on my feet again and race at a competitive level at some point.
So what were the greatest challenges, clearly coming into the kidney donation process and recognizing that I don't know how common it is, but it's one of the more common donations, I assume, is probably a healthy individual donating one of their two kidneys to a living donor and the world moving on. So it's a relatively common transplant procedure. Going into the experience, what did you, aside from your ability to compete at all, what did you feel was going to be the greatest challenge? Was it going to be the fact that your body would have to adjust to the single kidney? Would it be the dehydration that comes with that? Would it be the change in your body? Like, what were your questions going into it that you had to answer before you decided to make the donation?
Well, you're extremely right about that. This is a very common type of surgery. It's been done for a long time now with really high success rates. But certainly one of my concerns was, hey, I might not make it out the other side of the operating table, or I might have some serious complication. I did a lot of research on that, especially the hospital that I was going to have it at, and really was confident looking at all the available data about surgeries. So I think that was, while I still had to prepare for it, I had to have a will, that was pretty low. But you hit the nail on the head, dehydration. With just one kidney and not taking any NSAIDs, I know a lot of adventure racers love to use ibuprofen when they're out on the course to help with swelling. I can't do that. I really shouldn't get my body dehydrated, though unfortunately I did at a race a couple years after my donation. And it does take about a year for your remaining kidney. It kind of picks up the slack of the one that's gone. It gets bigger and you end up somewhere like 80, 90% of the functioning capacity that you used to have with two. That takes about a year to happen. So all those were certainly concerns. And I kind of dipped my toes back into things slowly, shorter distance, sprint races, cool weather. And I kind of ran into the roadblocks over time. One to add to that, which really took me by surprise during a C2C, I pulled out on the paddle. I was paddling for about 6 hours and I started to have a cramp just on one side of my abdomen. And it was the side where they had removed the kidney. And I just didn't know what that was. It was about 13, 14 months after the surgery. And no one had told me about that particular side effect. So I left the race rested And I've learned since then that when my abs get too tired, I can have these cramps on one side or the other of my abdomen now. I guess they must have cut a nerve or something during the surgery process that connects the two. So it was just kind of a weird after effect with no ramifications to my racing. I just take electrolytes and water and power through it.
Gotcha. So, and to your point, the body's pretty amazing that it adapts over time and the remaining kidney gets bigger and stronger and takes up some of the slack for the kidney that's lost.
Absolutely.
So, and I don't want to run past the event itself, but it sounds like to me that the real trick for you was to donate the kidney with obviously there's testing you have to go through with physical and as well as emotional, make sure you're giving it for the right reasons and all of that.
That's right.
And then after you donate the kidney, it sounds like you took your time, you recovered, you're already a fit individual going into it. And then it was really just time and patience and feeling your way back into the sport. It sounds like that was the plan that you had in your head, that there was no massive jump back into the sport. You didn't overestimate what you could or couldn't do. You just took your time, trained, and waited to see what would happen.
Yeah, I was told it'd take about a year and about 6 months of no significant ab work, i.e. paddling, but you could jog and run. So I think I did an adventure race here in DC, like a 4-hour, maybe 2 months after the surgery, did a 40-mile ultramarathon in West Virginia about 4 months after. And about 7 months after, I was out in Wyoming doing AR Worlds, not on a team that was trying to win, but a team that was trying to finish the course. And we did so. I wasn't as strong as I could have been, still not quite a year yet, but strong enough to get out there and continue doing what I really enjoy.
So let me ask you this question. Adventure racing alongside our other life experiences gives us a lot of, it brings us up close to challenges that we agree to, right? Grant Killian, who I try to mention every single podcast, because I want him to come back and put Untamed New England back on again. And this is my ability to light the bat signal. he talks a lot about contrived inconveniences. He said that back in one of the Untamed New England races, where we voluntarily throw ourselves into these situations. So therefore really don't get to complain about them. And if it's hard, it's hard, but we chose to be here. You chose to give the kidney and you choose to adventure race and you choose to take on these challenges. Have you ever thought about the Venn diagram of your personality overlaying with your desire to give the kidney, or did you never make that connection?
No, honestly, I never thought about it. It was just a matter of circumstance of finding out that someone was in need and at a time in my life where I was feeling very successful at work. My wife and I were earning enough money that looking ahead, we knew we were going to have a good life. And it was kind of like, okay, what else can I do in this world to make it a better place? And I think as most of us mature, we realize the childhood dream of helping the whole world just isn't something that we can do as an individual. What we can do is we can make 1, 2, 3, 10 people's lives better. And that's kind of where my head was at that time. And I thought, hey, I can make this person's life better. It'll take a little bit of recovery from me and a little bit of risk, but it'll completely change this person's life. So that was my equation at that time. And it was a pretty simple one.
Gotcha. Because there is the ripple in the pond effect, right? By you donating the kidney, he's restored to a life of more normalcy. And therefore his entire family, that entire ship is righted. And then they could go together as a group where that situation for their family goes away. So you didn't just help him, you helped everybody who he comes into contact with.
Yeah, and the hope going through, moving on to the Seven Summits climbing is not to, hey, look, I want to climb a bunch of mountains, but there's a pretty common belief out there that if you donate an organ, whether it be a kidney, part of your liver or whatever, you're somehow handicapped. And I've just found that to be completely not true. I found some other people that strongly agree with that. Garrett Hill, the CEO of the National Kidney Registry and founder of the Donor Games, also a living donor who agrees strongly. And he helped fund me to do some of these climbs and show the entire world that, hey, you know, a living donor can go in some extreme environments, push your body to really extreme limits. And I've got no impact at all from the fact that I'm an organ donor.
Gotcha. Because probably the idea behind not giving the donation would be the issue that the donor would have such a negative impact on their life that he or she would not do it because they would become a different person as a result. And right. You're saying the answer is no. You're saying the answer is, and then you use the Seven Summits alongside your return to racing and your return to life, that the Seven Summits are one chapter in your ongoing example that you can be a donor and you can continue to live a fruitful and full life.
That's very true. I mean, adventure racing, we all understand. And I came back and had really good success at nationals 1 year, and I've won some smaller races, but certainly not on the level that some of our, you know, international ARWS type of races are. But I've had some success, and certainly no impacts to the fact that I'm a living donor. But I do avoid races that tend to be really hot, just because I don't want to put myself in those kind of situations where I have to decide, you know, hey, am I going to slow the team down because I need to cool down and get water, or not?
Gotcha. That's where the stakes get really high.
Yeah.
So why the seven summits? I know it sounds like an obvious question, but of all the things that you could have done to show your ability to live a life of normalcy post donation, how did you settle on the seven summits? Had you done any of the seven previous to giving the kidney?
No, I hadn't. I had done Mount Rainier with a group of adventure racers like in 2010 timeframe, and we had an absolute ball. And I was fortunate to live with someone who was at a lot of experience mountain climbing when I was stationed in Los Angeles before I retired after my kidney donation. And we did a lot of climbing in the Sierra Nevadas. And it's tough and very enjoyable when you make it to the top. But I was limited by work on climbing outside of the States. And, you know, in the U.S., outside of Alaska, you're kind of capped at 14.5. To do real big mountains, you've got to fly either to the Andes in South America or to the Himalayan Plateau. And that just took too much time off. So the decision I made was, well, I'm just going to retire then, because I really enjoy climbing. And if I can do it for a good cause, maybe it can help finance some of the expenses, because doing the seven summits typically runs about $150,000, give or take, which is a lot of cash mm-hmm. for anybody, even if you're super wealthy. And like I said, I had the good fortune getting some sponsorship, friends and family helped out, having a good cause, and that really enabled the climbs to happen.
So of the seven summits that you climbed, did you have to go into them? And I'll let you talk about them individually. And I have the list here, what you covered. What was it like making the transition? You retired from you had the kidney donation, you retired from your job, you had the time at your disposal, you had the capital somewhat available to go and do all of that. What was the training like? How big was that leap? Putting aside the recovery from your kidney donation, how much work did you have to do in advance of all of those? Or did your adventure racing fitness and did your ultra marathon fitness, did that carry you forward? Or was there a whole new brand new, was there a brand new set of training you had to undertake for the seven summits?
Yes to both. The adventure racing training mentally is so powerful. I've not done any other sport that's challenged me so much mentally other than adventure racing, even more so than mountaineering. Carried me all the way through. But mountaineering is a different sport. A lot of rope climbing involved, the high altitude and what it does to your body. You just got to experience that a few times and start understanding how you can function in that environment. So the environment's very different itself. And it's a slow burning type of activity. Your heart rate's, you know, 120, 130, you're climbing for 6 to 8 hours and then hitting the tent and resting, because at that elevation, you just can't work like you can in an adventure race for 24 hours straight. You've got to have the body recover. So there were some differences dealing in the extreme cold, high winds as you get up to the top of those big mountains is also a big change. Certainly, I didn't have to worry about overheating in this new hobby, though.
Gotcha. And it's interesting you bring up the idea of the need to climb for a certain amount of time and then rest and recover, because adventure racing, especially those who do long expedition races, they go days and days and days without sleeping. They'll sleep 7, 8, 9, 10 days over the course of 7, 8, 9, 10 hours over the course of 5 days. You're saying that would not have been a successful recipe for you during your climbing.
Yeah, the key with climbing is you need to have the maximum amount of energy for summit day. Summit's always the hardest because it's the highest. Typically, it's the longest day, typically the most gain of any one day. And the way I think of mountaineering was proposed to me by a former guide of Mount Everest and other big mountains. His name's Chris Klinke. But he said, think of it like your body like a battery. The higher you go, the less recharge you're going to get every night. So if you drain your battery too much in one day, you're not going to be able to charge it all the way back up at all anymore. And now you've capped your total amount of energy expenditure that you can produce the next day by that much.
Well, and so the goal, go ahead. Because you do pass a point where recovery is not possible.
Yes.
At certain heights, correct?
Yeah, and a great example is at Everest. We were at base camp over 17,000 feet for over a month. I got a bacterial or viral infection, we're not sure what, in my gut, along with a couple of my Sherpa teammates. We couldn't get rid of it. We tried three different antibiotics. We were resting, and our bodies at that level, as soon as we stopped taking medicine, it would just flare right back up again. And it stuck with us all the way until we got off the mountain. So at sea level, that probably would have been a day or two, and my body would have been back to normal again.
So in many ways, it's a race against time.
It can be, but it's more about just taking care of yourself, making sure you eat when you're not hungry, making sure you drink when you're not thirsty, forcing yourself to rest even though you're tired of sitting in your tent. As you get up to these big mountains, and I'm not talking 14ers, I'm talking 20,000 and up, that's the strategy to be the most successful on summit day.
Of the seven summits that you came across, and I'm sure that each one had its own memories and each one had its own challenges and things like that, What was the of those seven, which was the one that you felt you had reached a point in your training and your climbing and things went in your direction where it was a good thing to climb, it was a hard thing to climb, but everything kind of came together for you? The weather came together, your training came together, your support crew came together. Which of the seven mountains did you feel like you kind of knocked off pretty quickly?
Well, I started in 2020 with Kilimanjaro that January, and then COVID hit. I had flights to go to two other mountains, including Denali, that had to be canceled. And so I kind of did this restart through COVID. I did a lot of volunteer work in COVID to keep myself busy with COVID shelters and testing sites and Team Rubicon, a disaster relief organization. So it kind of took me out of everything. I mean, adventure racing was virtual. We all remember that. Mm-hmm. It was a weird time. And early 2021, travel started to open back up internationally. And I knew I wasn't ready to get out and climb these big mountains, but I had come up with a schedule. I wanted to do Denali. Denali and Everest are really conflicting seasons. Technically, you can do both. I just don't see how you can come off of Everest strong enough to climb Denali, but it's technically possible. I wanted to do Denali first, and that would set me up for a shot at Everest the next year. But Denali is one of the toughest of the seven summits, and I needed a lot of practice before I got there. I was also going to climb with two very experienced mountaineers and doctors, as well as a Purple Heart Summit recipient from the Army, Ben Breckheimer, who had done six of the seven summits. He had failed on Denali before, so we were going to try to get him up for his seventh. So there was a lot riding on Denali. And in order to prepare for it, I climbed in Chile in February, and I went back down to Ecuador in April, climbing 18, 19,000 foot mountains, glaciated mountains. And, you know, the combination of that with the skilled team and the great guys that we had on Denali, everything came together. That mountain's got a 50% success rate. And getting to the top of that, all of a sudden, I looked at the rest of the year going, well, you know, with Everest about a year from now, I wonder if I can get all the rest of the mountains in before then and do them in under a year. And that was the first time I really had the thought of, instead of taking multiple years to do this, because Denali's done successfully, I can really crush through the rest of these mountains and be ready as I possibly can at that point for Everest next year.
And so to that point, and shout out, by the way, to your support crew and your teammates, once again, an adventure racing connection, right? Because yeah. Our teammates and the way that we work together says everything about how races are going to go. And that's agnostic to a 4-hour race, to a 10-day race, right? It's all about
who we talk to each other, because if someone's having a problem on the mountain, but they're not telling you, you can't help them. And then they're going to fail. And you're going to look back and look at all the ways you could have helped them out. But if the communication's not there, people don't make it to the summit.
Right. Most common piece of advice that we hear from coaches in adventure racing is talk to your teammates when you're feeling good and when you're not feeling good, so that the lines of communication are open the entire time. So I'm doing my quick math here. You did Kilimanjaro in 2020, and then 2020 was what it was. And it sounds like you knocked off the remaining six mountains in the space of, is my math right? Is it 15 months?
335 days. I started with Denali.
I take it away. Under 12 months.
Wow. Yeah, went to Elbrus, and I actually did Kilimanjaro a second time just because I wanted to get them all done within 1 year. And then moved down to Antarctica over the winter.
So you had already taken care of Kilimanjaro. Like, that was off the list.
Yeah.
But you're like, you know something, I think I could do it all inside of a year. So you went back to Kilimanjaro and you did it the second time.
I did. And I did it with a group called the World's Highest Obstacle Course Race.
Sure.
Led by a Brit named Dave Pickles, who's just okay. Awesome. It was just like a party every night going up the mountain. And then we did the obstacle course in the crater at 18,800 feet. I had a fantastic climb because I knew to go slow to eat, to drink, and rest. And I ended up placing third at the World Championship High Altitude Obstacle Course that we had there. And we were part of earning 2 Guinness World Records in the process. So it was a really successful climb. Made a bunch of great friends. Highly recommend anybody who likes high altitude and obstacle courses. They're doing Mount Everest this fall, base camp. If you ever want to go to base camp and do an obstacle course, this is probably your one chance to do it.
So let me ask you a question, because I'm curious about this. Recognizing that your military experience gave you a strong base, your adventuration gave you a base. Your training had to be super specific for this. I mean, now you're talking about adventure racing. I'm sorry, obstacle course racing at 18,000 feet. You're talking all those mountains under a year. Did you do specific training for this? Like what would, in a broad stroke, how much was your training different for this attempt under 12 months, mind you, than your other parts of your life? Or did you just lean on your base? Was it a lot of just being strong and just being able to carry a lot of weight and move steadily?
Yeah, pretty much I classify all that under suffering. And any mountaineer of big mountains knows that mountaineering equals suffering is a pretty useful equation. And adventure racing, especially when you start getting into the multi-day, is about suffering and continuing to put one foot forward no matter how you feel, no matter what the conditions are. And I really drew on what I've learned through adventure racing and my experiences, especially on Denali, Aconcagua, and Everest. Because as you get that high, as you approach 20,000 feet, you push past it, you're out there for multiple days, and in the terms of Everest, 2 months of tent camping, being dirty, not showering, being in dirty clothes, not feeling good, you still do it.
So of those mountains and all the mountains you did, how close were you to any one of the 7 of not summiting?
Oh boy, good question. You know, I was fortunate. I've had great teams. I've had good weather. On every single mountain I climbed, with the exception of Australia, I had people on my team not make it. I would say the closest I came was Everest. The folks who follow me on Facebook, my Facebook account's public, and also under Adventure Kidney, you can go back and see the first time I tried to climb the Camp 3. I never climbed above 7,000 meters before and didn't know this at the time, but that's kind of a magic number. The first time you do it, the wheels tend to fall off. And that happened to me hard going up Lhotse Face. I got extremely cold, started to feel like my fingers were going to be frostbitten. I was leaning down in what we call the tripod position in EMT work, where your, you know, hands are on your knees and your head's kind of down between your legs because you can't get enough air. And I thought my climb was done. It was only an acclimatization hike, but I thought there's no way I'm going to get to Camp 3 and climb Lhotse Face. And I came back down the mountain to base camp. I got a Facebook message from adventure racing friend, Glenn Gibson, who has climbed Choyu, another 8,000 meter peak. And he said, "Hey, Dave, I saw your post. Same thing happened to me when I climbed Choyu. The first time I broke 7,000, I thought I wasn't going to make it. It was awful. I thought I was done. And I came back, rested, and had a fantastic summit attempt and made the summit." And he really helped turn my spirits around with that message.
Yeah, Glenn's a great guy, Glenn. And as an example of that, the fact that he, let's keep in mind too, that we're grateful that we have this technology at our disposal where many of us at home, myself included, were following along. And I remember your post following that hike and how that went for you and how you tried to get up the mountain. And I remember thinking to myself that it clearly came across in your post that the entire attempt was in jeopardy. That was very obvious.
I cried when I wrote the post. I thought, this is it. You know, I'm going to be honest and tell people that this looks bad. And I'll tell you, yeah, I've raced with Glenn a couple of times. He and I ended up racing together during the Stokeville a couple of years back when they allowed solos, and we finished together because I was hurt. And so he was staying with me to make sure I made it in. And, you know, that kind of friendship save me on Everest. You know, the adventure racing builds those kinds of relationships.
And so Everest worked out, right? So Everest was the mountain that you were concerned about. And that was very obvious in your postings. You talked about Kilimanjaro. You ended up doing it twice. Do I remember correctly that there was some drama around Russia, around Elbrus?
Yeah. So I couldn't get there for a while because Russia wasn't allowing Americans in the country. And all of a sudden in late July, they started approving visas. And so I rushed, luckily I lived near DC, and got my visa approved. And I was looking on a map, and strangely enough, Kilimanjaro and Elbrus are actually kind of just above each other by, you know, a couple thousand miles. They're the same time zone. And so I had the idea, well, shoot, I can do Elbrus as a warm up to Kilimanjaro. And since Kilimanjaro is kind of this competition, I'll already be acclimatized. And I can knock out both of these mountains at the same time. And so I was able to do that and flew by myself to Russia, retired military. I don't think I'd ever do that again. But the people, when you go through...
By the way, when you got home, the FBI is like waiting at the end of the gate, like,
yeah,
Mr. Ashley, come have a conversation with us. How did you enjoy Russia?
We landed in Moscow and they stopped the plane on the tarmac, and the pilot came over and said, well, I don't know what's going on. This has never happened before, but Russian authorities have asked us to stop here while they review our passenger manifest and give us final approval to come in. And I thought, oh, for sure, a car's going to come up. They're going to come in with guns. They're going to escort me off the plane. And you're never going to see me again.
And now that day would be an adventure.
More than I'm ready
never,
to have.
Never mind Elbrus. The Kilimanjaro is easy. It's the navigating the Russian prison system while we're all sitting here signing petitions for you. Holy cow. Right.
And so grateful I decided to go the first chance I had. Well, Elbrus's weather window really is July and August, but I ended up going in September. But of course, we all know what's happened since then.
Right.
Americans can't get to Russia, and I don't see that changing anytime in the near term. So if you're trying to do the Seven Summits, Mont Blanc's a backup to Elbrus. I guess people are stuck going to France instead.
Gotcha. So so it sounds like the all the pieces came together for you where the weather windows were there. You didn't get completely knocked out. You had to wait, obviously, right? I mean, the window had opened up. But there are some stories, you read enough high mountain stories. There are some times where there's never a weather window. Like Everest went through that several years ago where there were no summits. I think it was one of the years, and it wasn't due to the earthquake and it wasn't due to COVID. The fact that the weather never turned nice enough for people to make a legitimate attempt at it. And so you got really... I mean, you set yourself up, you know, the expression, we make our own luck, right? And you made your own luck, right? You were there, you were available. How did the other ones go? How did Vincent go and Koos go? Like, were those, you know, we run the risk of falling into relativity here. It's still the Seven Summits, and these are still significant climbs to go up. How did Vincent and how did Koos go for you? How did you like Antarctica?
Vincent's an interesting one. I mean, it's a long way from the United States to Antarctica. It takes a couple hours to go to Miami, and then from there 8 hours to go to Santiago, and then from there 5 hours to fly to Punta Arenas, the very southern part of Chile, and then from there it's like another 5 hours across the Drake Passage to camp, the main glacier camp, and then from there it's another 45 minutes by small ski plane to the base camp for Mount Vinson. It's a short season, really the end of November, kind of early December timeframe to about mid-January. And unfortunately, everything down there, because of all the transportation you have to do, is really expensive. For example, gas ends up costing about $100 a gallon to get all the way down there. And so when you're heating up food, you think about, okay, $100 a gallon for that camp fuel. So you end up paying the operator a lot of money for the opportunity to climb Vincent. And so you've got this like 7-day window to climb it. And that's it. You've got to get out of there. The next group's got to come in. So we were a couple of days in. The weather was looking good. There's a base camp, camp one, camp two, and the summit for Vincent. We were at camp one, a couple groups had climbed the fixed ropes up to camp two, and then the weather changed. And we had to come all the way back to base camp, build snow walls, and kind of prep for a pretty big storm. It looked like we weren't going to be able to make it at all. And you can imagine the spirits were pretty low. Everybody spent like $40,000 to be here, and we're not going to get a shot at climbing the mountain. But at the very end of our stay, the weather blew over. We hustled back to camp one, shot up to camp two, and then immediately went for the summit and made it. And it was extremely cold, real windy. I think it was about negative 40 before you added wind chill. And the summit ridge to get to the very top of Vincent is mixed climbing with a lot of exposure. And so you think about, here you are, you're in the Antarctic continent, a couple hundred miles from water. The only thing that can fly out to you is a ski plane that can only land if the weather's good. And that's only the base camp. So if you get hurt, you have to get all the way to base camp or die. That was kind of a realization that we had right before we started climbing up to the summit, was just be really, really, really careful on this next like half an hour.
Yeah. because a lot of the mountains are, for as remote as they are, because they're relatively well traveled. Not that they're safe, but there's a bit more infrastructure built around them from a rescue perspective. So if something were to go wrong on Kilimanjaro, something were to go wrong in the other mountains, not that it's easy to get to, but it's easier to get to, where it sounds like in Antarctica, you were on your own.
Camp at 17,000 feet, the National Park Service has a base and they can get helicopters in.
Right.
Everest now at Camp 2. In fact, one of my friends from Kilimanjaro was rescued out of Camp 2 because he was getting pulmonary edema. So they're able to fly up to Camp 2. If you watch old Everest movies, they couldn't do that. Base camp was as high as they could go, and even that was really shaky.
Right.
So the quality of rescue care has really gone up. On Aconcagua, they can fly up to Camp 2. But in Antarctica, even though it's only 16,000 feet, there's nothing out there. So it's probably one of the most dangerous mountains from the perspective of, if you get hurt, you're really in bad shape.
So what were and I'm sure the laundry list is pretty long, the respective relative dangers of there? Was it going through a crevasse? I'm talking about for all seven of the summits, not just for Antarctica. Was it elevation, fixed ropes? Was it taking a fall? Was it going through a crevasse? Was it exposure? Like, what would you, as you look back on the experience of the seven summits, what were the greatest tension points, the greatest danger points that you had to contend with?
Yeah, I think Denali, you're on fixed ropes the whole time with your team, and there's small fixed rope sections, but you're roped together. Weather is probably the most dangerous thing on Denali. On Elbrus, if you hit it in July and August, you can literally be there in like a t-shirt. I was there on a day when it was like negative 20 and windy. So I think wind exposure there, and same with Antarctica, wind exposure. Kilimanjaro, probably your stomach is the biggest danger. A lot of people get a stomach illness from water or food on their trip, and don't make it to the top because they don't feel well. But otherwise, you do such a slow climb, like either 7 or 8 days up Kili, that altitude sickness really doesn't get that many people. Aconcagua, however, I'd say altitude sickness is probably the number one, because it's such a high mountain. There's no other mountain close to it outside of the Himalayan plateau. It's almost 23,000 feet high. Most people just can't handle that unless they have other high altitude mountain experience. Which is one of the reasons I wanted to do it near the end, when I did have a lot more experience. And then Everest, the ice fall is absolutely dangerous. Big crevasses, you're crossing on ladders, and the ice is moving. It was different every time I went through it. That's not one place I'd be excited to go back to again.
Yeah, it feels like you kind of snatched one from Everest, right? When you think about it.
Everybody was saying the weather has been the best this season than for the last several years. The ice fall, the route was not as complicated. Even the path from camp one to camp two, which sometimes can have these really huge crevasses, we had, you know, single ladder and jump across kind of crevasses. So it was kind of a magical year to be on Everest. I think if we look back and see the stats, you're going to see real high summit rates for this last year.
Yeah. Alan Arnett is the preeminent Everest. He catalogs every season. He's talking about how this year is just camp, team after team is just making it to the top one after the other. So, but the window could close and you cannot get there for 2, 3, 4 years, right? So you have to go while you can.
That's true.
Aside from the aerobic capacity that you had to focus on and the ability to suffer, what about how much were your technical skills in terms of your climbing skills? You mentioned fixed ropes. If somebody's sitting at home and if they want to consider something of this nature, right, recognizing that seven summits are a big deal, aside from the gear that they would need and aside from the endurance training, technically speaking, how proficient do you have to be?
Well, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, that was me, like, gosh, maybe like in 2012 or so. I actually called up like Alpine Ascents and said, hey, I did Rainier. I want to climb Everest next. You know, and they're very nice about it. I think they get those kind of calls a lot. And they're like, Right. Well, there's other mountains you probably should do to make sure you're ready on Everest. And to be fair, I did see several mountaineers who did not do the requisite prep. You see them in the ice fall, you see them at the yellow band between camp 3 and camp 4, and then you see them on summit day in the technical sections where there's mixed climbing, and they shouldn't be on the mountain because there's one rope everybody's using, and literally there were hours of delays on summit day because of some of these people.
Gotcha. Where they could buy their way there.
Yes.
But buying your way there. And I definitely, let's not forget this. I want to come back to the Sherpas, because the level of attention that you've given to them in your posts has been impressive. So I want to hear about their story in a second. Sure. But I think the point you're making is correct, that there are people who basically fly their way all the way to Everest Base Camp, and they think that all they have to do is follow someone to the top. And that's not the way it is.
Right. It's not a place you want to learn how to use crampons, for example.
Gotcha.
You asked about technical skills. Crampon use is absolutely vital. From the time you leave base camp, you go a couple hundred meters, and then your crampons are on. And then they're on all the way until you summit, and you come all the way back down again. So knowing how to walk safely, knowing how to cross side hilling, snowfields, crevasses. I practiced walking across ladders in my crampons before I went, all in an effort to make sure that I wasn't the cause of any kind of a long jam, and also for my own safety and comfort. The more things you can do in advance, and mentally you realize, okay, I know how to do that, I'm confident, and you don't have that anxiety, the more energy you're going to have to focus on breathing and stepping. But if you're scared and you're doing things for the first time, you're going to be really, really slow, and you're likely not going to make it up to the top. So most people would say in the United States, hey, I want to climb something like Everest. Great. Go to Rainier. Before Rainier, if you've not done a 14er, at least get up to that elevation, see what it feels like before you get to Rainier. Again, you don't want to do something for the first time on a tough glaciated mountain. But Rainier's got some fantastic routes. Emmons Glacier, Disappointment Cleaver are two of the more popular ones for first time or newer climbers, but like Liberty Ridge is for, you know, expert professional level climb. So we're lucky in the United States to have a mountain that has that kind of environment, even though it's not that high. And then the next step is you want to get up high, and you want to make sure genetically your body's able to do that, because some people just can't deal with the high altitude and get sick. So a mountain like Kilimanjaro, a mountain in the Andes, I climbed Tapaca near Santiago. It's 18.8, you know, something along that range that has a glaciated peak. Cotopaxi is a great one, would be kind of the next step up from Rainier. And then from there, I do Denali. Denali is kind of like the test. If you can do Denali, I think you're ready to go and do an 8,000 meter peak. If I could do it again, I'd probably do Troyu first. Then come back a year later and do Everest, because it was the first time on Everest I had used oxygen. And it took me a full day to really get comfortable with that. And it was also the first time I had worn a full puffy suit. And it took me a day or two to really get used to how to vent and how that works. And that was a lot of mental energy I spent that I could have been focused on stepping forward and breathing instead.
How much of the experience on Everest did you have to fight against your natural inclinations? Like, you weren't thirsty, you made yourself drink. You wanted to ignore the need to vent the puffy suit. You made yourself, like, how much of it, at the end of the day, how much of it was a mental exercise as opposed to physical?
Yeah, I mean, your points are hitting on are really on self-care. And it's a lot like a long adventure race. If you ignore that whisper that says, hey, I'm a little thirsty, or hey, I'm a little hot, or hey, I need to pee, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And so it might seem like, hey, I'm kind of stopping every 20 minutes to 40 minutes, but you're doing it really quick, and you're keeping your body kind of in that narrow happy zone. If you get outside of that, things go south really quick. And I think on that day where I really suffered and had a bad day, I didn't have the right gear on. I didn't have the right gear in my pack to add as I got colder. And I didn't communicate with the Sherpa I was with about my condition until it was too late. And it turned more into a recovery than it could have been a prevention kind of exercise.
Got it. Good lesson. Good lesson for the aspiring adventure racer and the veteran adventure racer out there to recognize that it's all about you're desperate to keep moving forward. So you want to ignore the pebble in your shoe. You want to ignore the hunger and all of a sudden you find yourself in a hole. And especially at altitude and especially when recovery is not there, to not recover from it is just, then you're doomed. And I'm not being dramatic. There are people probably in Everest who didn't come off of Everest because they ignored those early signs and they were too far in the hole. You mentioned the Sherpas and you talk so eloquently about the Sherpas in your post. And it sounds like with any mountain that you tackled as part of the Seven Summits, including the Seven Summits and as well as the training mountains, it sounds like you just surrounded yourself with the greatest people.
Very fortunate in that regard. Again, great advice from my friend, Chris Klinke, who also used to do adventure racing in his day too. He told me when I went to Everest, hey, you don't need a Western guide. The Sherpas know the mountain better. They live there. They've grown up there. They have this network. They know everybody on the mountain. And so I didn't go with a Western guide. I went with two Sherpas as guides. One had summited 9 times. One had summited 6. And I was never, ever in question whether or not I was going to make it. Their whole focus for me was watching every click I did with my carabiners, every step I did through the ice fall, what I ate, what I drank. They were on me the whole time. I mean, it definitely was annoying at times, like that adventure racing teammate that's telling you to eat when you're like, I'm just trying to stay awake right now, shut up. But, you know, I put that voice, that disagreeing voice away and just focused on saying, yes, I can do that. Yes, I can do that. And did whatever they told me to do. And they know that mountain. They know climbers. I'm not going to say it was easy, but we certainly summited faster than the original plan had called for because I was performing better than the baseline climber that they have planned for. So we only did one acclimatization hike. Instead of resting for a full week before the summit, we only rested for 3 days. We did everything except I was hoping to do a second 8,000 meter peak, and the weather just didn't cooperate. The high winds that we were trying to avoid came a little bit early, and we had to not climb Lhotse. But doing both would have been just, I could have retired from, I think, adventuring at that point.
That would have been it, right? Doing the double, one on top of the other. So it's holy cow. It's like winning the World Series and Super Bowl in the same year. To your point, they took very good care of you. Were they aware of your single kidney?
Very much so. Yeah. And they felt strongly about the cause I was doing it for. And they reassured me, especially after that day where I really fell apart, that, hey, you've got this. We're going to be there for you. We're going to make sure. But at the same time, they weren't like pulling things out of my pack. They weren't attaching me to their ropes. They wanted me to climb it.
Right.
They didn't want to push me or pull me up the mountain.
Yeah, you weren't getting a short rope to the top.
I was grateful for that too.
Yeah, they weren't going to drag you up there. You're going to earn it on your own.
No, I had to climb the mountain. They're very adamant. We're not here to, you know, pull you up. You have to climb this mountain. Right. And that's how I wanted to do it. That's how I did all my other mountains.
And isn't there just an incredible little comment on human nature and human purpose and performance when you tie yourself and let's be honest, you're the focal point of the project, right? You're the face of the project. You're the guy doing it. But everybody you brought along with you, the Sherpas, the people helping you make your travel, the sponsors, everybody had a greater sense of investment in your success because you were serving a higher purpose, which was letting people know that you can be a living kidney donor and still have a very rich and fulfilling life. And I'm willing to bet there's a certain percentage of greater performance you got out of everybody because there was they were doing more than just bringing a Westerner to the top of Everest. They were bringing someone along who was a powerful example to other people of what could be accomplished. And therefore, everybody was just harder working, more dedicated, more positive going across that. And that really speaks to what your project did for everybody. It gave everybody a sense of greater purpose, and therefore, they were even more invested in it.
I agree with that. And on the flip side, it gave me a huge amount of anxiety of what if I fail, especially on Everest when I had done all the other ones. That day when I didn't do well and I came back down to base camp and was just, you know, mentally had lost it. Pulling myself back together and refocusing and getting back to one foot in front of the other was so hard because I knew people were looking. I mean, I had quit my military career And I told the three-star at the time, he asked me why. I said, I want to climb Mount Everest. And he rolled his eyes and shook his head and laughed. And I had to do it.
So let me ask you another question. So then, aside from you just giving yourself a mental pep talk in your tent, what else did you draw upon to do that? Did you speak with anybody? Did the Sherpas play a role? Did you use your communication to talk to people at home? Like, I think it's, once again, all things come back to adventure racing. If you race long enough, you're going to find yourself in a hole at some point during a race. And there are people who are able to step outside of that hole and continue on with the race and have great races, right? I had an experience recently with a teammate who was sick as a dog in the beginning of a race and wanted to come out of the race early through. And we were able to bring that person along and ended up having a great experience, who did the navigation for the last half of the race. Tell us that story. How did you get yourself out of that Camp 3 hole?
Well, you're exactly right. I've also seen in races where someone, you think there's no way they're going to keep going, and then the next day they're the strongest person on the team. I was lucky in that we went down after that bad day, and we had 3 days down at base camp. And I let myself kind of, I call it a mourning period. Whenever I make a pretty bad mistake, I give myself some period of time to just dwell on it, just focus on it, feel bad about myself, get it out of my system, flush it. And I gave myself, we got in maybe around lunchtime. I gave myself that whole day. I did my Facebook post. I was sad for myself. I woke up the next day and the guide said, hey, why don't you walk down to Gorik Shep? It's about a 3-hour walk along the trekking trail and come back up just to do something so your body isn't just sitting. And so I started heading down to Gorik Shep and I said, you know what? F that. I'm going to head back up to Pomare Base Camp, which I had climbed as an acclimatization hike leading up to going up to Camp 3. And so I went by myself without a guide. I had had a guide before, and I climbed up there. It's about 1,000 feet above base camp, crushed it, did it about 3 hours faster. I'm sorry, an hour faster than I had done before. I'd done it in 4 hours. I did it in 3 this time. And just, you know, physically showing myself, hey, you're acclimatizing, you're stronger because of what you just did, even though you didn't do as well as you wanted, you're going to be ready to go back and climb back up. And I came back down from that. I told the Sherpas, hey, I knocked an hour off my time, feeling good, really focused on eating and drinking. That's the fundamentals. And then 2 days later, we went back up the mountain.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Well, I was looking at something that's not really widely known, but it's called high pointing. And this is going to the highest point in every state in the U.S. And the reason I'm thinking about that is there's still quite a bit of the country I haven't seen. And one of my lessons learned from doing these 7 summits is the traveling was just so enriching. I mean, going to countries, continents I'd never been to before, meeting people that enjoyed the same thing I did. So I'm looking about starting next month in June and reaching out on Facebook to people who might live near these places where I might couch surf, or maybe they want to come climb with me. Some of them you literally just drive up to. I mean, we're talking Florida.
I'll bring you to High Point, High Point, New Jersey. I will personally escort you to High Point, New Jersey.
There we go. You know, and I've already done Denali.
One down, 49 to go.
I've done Whitney, you know, so some of the real challenging ones are already done. But there's still ones like Elbert in Colorado, mm-hmm. like Hood. There's some fun mountains. And I think one or two states are like, you know, a 20 some mile hike in and overnight camping. And so to me, that just sounds like a lot of fun. It cost a whole lot less than what I just did, but still gets me out to see some people and to do what I really enjoy doing, which are these long treks and hikes. I've also talked with a company I climbed Everest with about getting together a group of like adventure racers or really fit people to do like an Everest base camp or Annapurna base camp trek, or even like I climbed a acclimatization peak, Lobiche East. That was a 20,000 foot climb, but it was only about 4 hours in crampons and on fixed ropes, but a great first time for someone who's looking at doing something like Rainier, like Denali, maybe like Everest one day. So there's some potential there for me to lead some groups back to Nepal.
What does that look like if someone wanted to go from America to Nepal? What time of the year and how long is the time commitment?
Typically the treks are done either in the spring or the fall. And most of them last 10 to 15 days, depending on what trek you want to go on. They're surprisingly inexpensive. Treks usually are like $1,500 to $2,000, which includes all your lodging, breakfast and dinner. And then you just pay for bottled water, buy your lunch, and you can choose to carry your own gear or have a porter. Honestly, the plane tickets are, you know, in that same price range, $1,500, $2,000. So you're looking at under $5,000.
Gotcha.
For a 2-week trip to Nepal.
Gotcha.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that might be the most dangerous thing I've heard this entire podcast. Are you going to write a book about it?
A lot of people have asked, and I went so far to talk to an agent that connects people that are looking to put a book together with authors, and the cost really shocked me. About $50,000 is what they want for someone to write a book with you, a professional. And that's just not something I'm interested in funding. So I put a lot of detail onto my Facebook post, especially in the pictures. That's kind of like my living journal. Maybe one day I'll do a more extensive blog on the experience, particularly aimed at someone who wants to follow in my footsteps and talk about some of the logistics hurdles and travel and some of the things I learned along the way. That would have really been helpful to me. But I don't think there's going to be a book unless someone wants to help write one for me at a much lower cost than that. Yeah.
So there are a few published authors I know who are fans of the Dark Zone, because there's some crossover there with adventure racing. And right now they're probably saying to their podcast player, well, Dave, just start writing it, right? Just give yourself a page, 2 pages a day. All of a sudden you look up and after 100 days, you have 200 pages, you got a book there. And so I think that's what they would probably, the advice they would give you is just to get started. And then eventually it gets a lot easier to get looked at by an editor when you're giving them something, as opposed to having someone write it with you.
They can take the pile of crap I put together and actually make it readable.
Well, that's their job, right? That's their job. Right. Literally, they're called editors. Well, Dave, I really appreciate your time today. I really appreciate you coming on the Dark Zone. Were there any questions that you think, I didn't ask that you want to talk about, or anything you think the audience should know that you didn't say?
Yeah, you know, adventure racing is such a full body sport that the transition for me into mountaineering really only took a bit of skill learning, crampons, rope work, mental game, 100% I was ready. And physically, you know, my body, I can stay on my feet for hours and hours at a time, which is what you have to do in mountaineering. And with the heavy packs and that high altitude and in bad environmental conditions, you suffer a lot. So I really encourage you. Adventure racers who are interested, reach out to me, Facebook, through my website, adventurekenny.com. I basically want to just keep climbing, and I'm looking for people to go with. So I'm not charging anybody any money. I'm not guiding, but I'd happily help put a trip together to like Ecuador, to Chile, to Argentina, to Nepal, anywhere in the U.S. to go climbing. We get a group together and let's go. It's just a lot of fun.
Thank you, Dave, for bringing us along with you during your incredible accomplishment. The Dark Zone is proud to know you and share your story with the world. We can't wait to see what's next. Thank you, listeners, for choosing to spend your time with us. We know that you have a lot of choices in today's world, and we value your time and attention. The Dark Zone will always remain free to its listeners. That's a promise. If you've enjoyed this episode, please pay a visit to your podcast streaming platform of choice and leave us a review. That is the best way to spread the word. Also, always feel free to reach out to me, Brian, at ardarkzone.com. Your feedback and guest suggestions are always welcome. Thank you, listeners, for joining us at the Dark Zone. Have fun out there.